Oh gosh, I don't even know what to say. Every single Sunday I go to look at the Spotify podcast to see if you guys released a new one. And then I forget you guys are on a break. I don't even know what to say here. Congratulations on your marriage. I can't wait for you guys to come back and give me some more funny stories and advice and tell me all about Turda and everybody. Thank you.
Call me love. You bought me a ring. Falling asleep, the sound of your breathing. Wide, wide eyes like this is my house. This is my life now, this is my spouse. Glory be, glory to you, glory to me. This is the
okay, hi, I'm sorry, I just called. I forgot about Georgie. Yes, we love Georgie too. We want to hear about her as well. That's all. Thank you.
The hotline, honey?
What?
It is popping off.
Is it everything you dreamed of?
It's so hot to the touch. There's so many voicemails spilling out of it. I had no idea. Also, the vast majority of them are just little balls of sunshine and rainbows and little happy unicorns sprouting to my ears of people just being like, hey, I love y'all so much.
It's like it's candy for my ears.
It's just, yes. It's like the good kind of being love bombed.
Yeah.
There's a bad kind of being love bombed, right?
Yeah. I think that term actually is not.
Oh, it's
good.
It's a bad thing. What if I'm saying a love balm? B-A-L-M.
Oh, that's always good.
I mean, love balmed.
Yeah.
But y'all.
I love that.
We absolutely love the voicemails.
Thank you so much for calling and leaving us these little nuggets of sunshine.
And keep them coming. And yes. I think you'll have a clearer idea after this episode of the variety of ways you can balm us.
Balm us.
Embalm us. 919-901-0861. That's the Manic Episodes hotline, baby. Hotline bling. Also, somebody asked why it's a North Carolina area code, and my answer is, I have no idea. It's a random phone number that Google Voice assigned to us. But we do love the both North and South Kakalakis.
You guys are so good, and we love you, and that's why we did it.
That's exactly. Oh yeah, it was intentional.
It was on purpose because we love North Carolina so much.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I feel like we need to acknowledge, like, that was just the cutest fucking voicemail with like two, like a part two, like making sure they didn't forget about Georgie.
There's actually, you know? And actually, mm-hmm. There's a super, super sweet North Carolina voicemail.
Oh my God, that's true.
Should we?
Yeah.
Is this a good segue?
Yeah, why not?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Right?
Hey, Mary and Wyatt. This is Sierra from Raleigh, North Carolina. I am listening to your season 3 opener, and I'm only about 30 minutes in because I'm about to go into my office, but I am listening to you guys talk about how people let you down at your wedding and hearing Mary cry, and my heart is just breaking. We got engaged at your show in Clemson, South Carolina. We were like the last people to meet you guys, and you signed our couples journal and celebrated with us. And that was incredibly meaningful. And you two have been just so intertwined in our relationship and just a big part of our growth and experiences. And I just wanted to, I don't know, just to convey that to you, how much you two matter and the impact and the difference that you make. You're so very loved and appreciated and adored. I love you, sweet people, so, so very much. You are so special and so loved. Thank you for being part of our lives.
That's so sweet. So sweet. We love you back.
We love you right back. And we remember y'all.
Yep, that's right. That was at the Clemson show. I cannot believe y'all got engaged that night.
We are maybe coming to a university near you, maybe, depending on where you are and depending on whether or not we finalize something. I guess that's quite tentative. But you never know what could happen in the future.
Who knows?
Who can ever say? So if y'all don't already know about this, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/manicepisodes, and you can get a shiny, beautiful, golden bit of bullshit lie told about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's an honor.
Yeah. It's a fucking, like, it's
it's the best bargain on all of Patreon.
I cannot believe we've been doing this for so long. And, like, I'm still, sometimes I'll just, like, giggle to myself in the car and be like, this is a good lie.
I giggled to myself making these lies. You did?
Yes. I'm so excited.
I get really excited. Like, my heart will start to race when I think, oh, my God. I'm serious.
Yes. It's just
I'll be
sweet.
Like, I can't wait to tell this lie I'm about to tell.
Okay.
Well, you wanna
go?
Just kidding. Okay. Well, my lies for this episode are a bit of a mixed bag.
Okay.
I think I've actually used this like exact same template, and I think I said the same thing before I started. Okay. Teddy and Jackson were just crowned the champions of a local D&D competition.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Really cool, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, D&D in this context stands for dings and dents, and it's an award given to the people with the most damaged car in the parking lot of the grocery store.
Oh my God.
The first story brought me a big smile and then a huge frown, but then a smile again because they won. That's the first one.
Honey, the twists and turns there.
Oh my God, I forgot to mention, we're having a Black Friday sale.
We are.
If you sign up for our Patreon, you get, at the $15 and up tier, you get a lie told about you.
Oh, what a great sale.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, major congratulations are in order for Tamara Y because they just won a Grammy.
Oh!
Well, it's not the Grammys you're thinking of. It's the annual gathering of grandmas.
We're kind of on the same wavelength yes. with these lies.
When you get a Grammy, it means you've received the respect of the noblest Grammy.
I just, like, scratched my elbow on your huge engagement ring. On the huge... on the, that
my
huge
diamonds.
Rock. Diamonds are forever. Oh, shit.
Don't look at her. Don't look at her
So Turnip is asleep on the couch mm-hmm. and, like... Mm-hmm. This thing happens. Y'all know when your dog's eye kind of rolls back and there's just like a...
Because they don't have real eyelids. They don't have eyelids.
There's just like a milky sliver.
Oh, jeez, honey. That's a descriptor.
Okay. Lilith just earned an MBA from Coastal Carolina University in Conway, South Carolina. Unfortunately, MBA in this context stands for massive boating accident.
Oh my God, honey.
Lilith caused when they accidentally let their jet ski slide off of the trailer and it smashed into somebody's yacht. Jeez, that sounds like it's going to be expensive.
I thought that we agreed that when we did this, no bad things were going to happen in the lies.
Well, it's like, but everybody learned something. Like, Lilith got a new jet ski, probably. I don't know. Okay, what's your next one?
Well, that's a flop. Or is it? Allie Faye is bringing floppy disks back. Party on and let's read some book reports.
Book reports.
I don't know. In my head, I'm like, because I use
I'm following you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I, to me, the connection absolutely made sense.
But I don't know. That probably doesn't make sense to like people who are older than us.
Older?
Yeah. Don't you think?
Well, maybe. And yeah, definitely because, more people who are younger than us,
yeah,
right?
I don't know. Yeah, that won't make sense. It feels like just in our demo.
About floppy disks, do you think about those ones that were like yay big? I'm demonstrating with my hands. Y'all know. That were actually floppy or soft? Or do you mean those ones that were like yay big that had like the little metal slidey
thing?
Yeah,
the metal slidey thing.
Oh, see? That's weird. Because that is what most people think of when they hear floppy disk. But there were those black disks that were like actually floppy. You could like bend them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Dang. Okay.
Wait, is that...
You know you're old when... That's Wait, the Facebook meme I'm coming up
was
with.
Was that before... That was... I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, Google it. Check on that shit.
Are you serious?
Yes, I swear. But I... Okay, but when... In common parlance, though, I think when people say floppy disks, can somebody please help me research?
Jamie,
look that up.
First generation...
That was a Joe Rogan Experience joke. I don't know if anybody is really topped into the zeitgeist.
These all look like... These.
These.
All.
There. See?
What?
That one.
What is that? I don't know what that
is. That's a floppy disk.
No, this is a custom retro game birthday.
Oh my God, what are they doing selling $293? Okay, yeah, no. Those are what people call floppy disks, but they're not the original
Why are floppy disks so expensive now? Because they don't make them anymore and now they're rare?
I don't know, but I can
hear. Oh, I see. Okay, yep. Like these.
Yep.
Wow.
See? Yes, the bigger one. This okay, is great.
You know what? I vaguely remember these.
This is great audio, isn't it?
Yeah, because we're looking at stuff.
Okay. Oh, I guess I forgot what we were talking about or doing.
Well, we... Oh, you know what? Right. The first person that left that message that we had on the first part asked about Turnip and Georgie, and I feel like...
Oh, yeah. It's a good time to update.
Some updates.
Turnip and Georgie update. Right, well, now...
Turnip is possessed with her creepy eyes.
So now it's gone from, like, just white milky orb to, like, a sort of a reddish sliver, sort of like a bruise. Sorry, I'm honing my creative writing skills.
The girls have been so much better, I would say, like, the last week or so.
Yeah, what would you say has made the difference?
Me.
And for those of y'all who are not, like, enculturated in our dog's behavioral problems, they are, I guess everything is relative, right?
Yeah.
Like, they haven't caused, you know, grievous bodily harm to anybody yet.
Except for you.
That's true. Both of them have bitten me at different times. But it's been a while.
It's been a while.
And they, it's not that they don't get along. They don't get into fights where they actually hurt each other. They just, like, sort of growl at each other and are obsessed with each other. Like,
yeah.
Following each other around, screwing with each other, like, getting in each other's way. Like, Turnip will do this thing where she'll walk up right beside Georgie, growling at her, and then, like, lift her leg up. And Georgie just, like, sniffs around her down there bits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand what's happening. Like, is that a show of dominance?
There's some power dynamics going on.
Right.
It's
a power
play.
Yeah, there are some power plays. And in that way, it's not unlike all of life. Am I right? Which is one big power play.
It reminds me of Robert California in The Office. He says, everything about life, everything is about sex. Except for sex. Sex is about power. And I think about it all the time.
I love, like, pseudo-profound insights like that. But actually, basically, in the dog's case, I guess, insofar as we're talking about their genitals, is maybe about both.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe you just let me say that. You're so, mm-hmm. You are so, like, I was like, oh, Mary's gonna be exhausted with me.
No.
But no, you just let that one slide. You just give it up.
Yeah, we're married. I don't fight it.
I mentioned the dog's genitals and it's just...
Yep.
Dead. Just nothing. Radio silence. But yeah, the struggle is to get them to leave each other alone.
Well, and also the couch is a little bit of a trigger because... We don't really have any rules, and I think that's probably part of it.
Yeah, but, like, I don't, we've talked about this recently. I don't want the kind of life where I'll read these dog training books and people will be like, don't let your dog enter the room before you. Don't let your dog onto the furniture. Don't speak at your dog. Don't look at your dog. Don't have fun with your dog. Don't smile around your dog. Like, that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah,
like, I don't know if I can do the drill sergeant thing.
Yeah.
Because if I'm thinking about it, I was a child of laissez-faire parents. I tend to be a laissez-faire parent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not a comfortable mode for me.
Yeah.
So the dogs think I'm a chew toy. They don't take me seriously. You've seen this. But they take Mary seriously.
Well, and I think they do. And they will, and when you snap, they're like, okay, and Dad's mad.
Yeah, and Mary will always, like, look at me when I stand up and I'm like, Georgie, no. And, you know, I kind of make myself big and she listens to me and Mary's always like, ooh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
that was good. Yeah, do more of that. You like it. Kind of like when I'll come home and I'll be like, I had to bring the, you know, crack the whip with some of my students today. They're being kind of annoying. And she's like, yeah, all right. Yeah, did you?
I just like it. I like, because I think it's so, like, counterintuitive, I guess. Not counterintuitive. It's so not what I would normally think you to be. You know, you're so gregarious and so sweet and kind. And so, like, when you're a disciplinarian, I'm like, that's hot. It's hot.
I really like that, actually.
Okay, let's turn this off.
Oh, my God. It's like my inner Angela Merkel or something. I don't know. That's so weird. I don't know why that just came to my mind.
I love that that's what you use.
But yeah, I And then you ran across something. You're like, holy shit, I saw the title of this book.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Your Dog is Your Mirror.
Yes.
And we both just sort of stared at each other in silence.
And I was like, well, our dogs are clinically insane. So, like, what does that mean?
Yep. Like, they are neurotic. And, and again, I know this is, but this to me, and I know we've talked about this a lot before, is in not a small way, a parenting dress rehearsal.
Yes.
And I want to take it seriously.
Yes.
And I see these tendencies in myself that I don't like, that I want to get under control by the time we have children, which is the next stop that we're going to get off on the life train.
I hope we don't get off on the life train.
We were just saying at Thanksgiving,
I want to stay on.
We spent Thanksgiving at our friend's. Jake and Aisha Burns, who Mary toured with, was on tour with us, with Aisha's husband, Jake, who's also amazing. And we spent Thanksgiving at Jake's parents' house. It was like beautiful farmhouse out in the beautiful countryside. And we were talking about how, like, getting married is this huge life milestone. It's also when everybody's paying, like, maximum attention to you.
Yes.
And
yes.
So we're both like, fuck, we have to have kids now.
Yeah, like, I can't stand to have the attention be waning. Like, no.
That's Teddy Roosevelt, who said about someone else that he wants to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and what's the third one?
And the baby at every christening. And I was like, that's me. That's me.
The second I read it, I was like, honey, I don't know if this is going to offend you. I read it, and then Mary was like, oh, it's me! Yes, it's you! but yes, so kids. So we're thinking about kids.
Yeah,
so
I can't have anyone not paying attention to us.
Yeah, no, it's too hard.
Mm-hmm. Keep paying attention.
I just...
You look stressed.
Because think about all the
stressed.
The life milestones where people pay a lot of attention to you, right? Birthdays when you're little.
Uh-huh.
Graduations, that's a big one.
Yep.
And that's also why I just continued to graduate.
Yep.
Because I was like, this is not enough attention. And it's still not. So like now I like try to make myself the bride at every wedding at like the graduations at my institution. Like remember when I got to carry like the flag thing? Because I'm like, okay, that's passed me by. So, well, when we have kids, then we'll be able to, it'll just be their accomplishment.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And but I think that's why it gets stressful, you know? Like, that's when your parents vicariously live through you. You don't want that.
So we have
to have our own accomplishments.
You don't want to vicariously live through our kids?
No, I don't think you should. I don't think that's good.
What would that look like to you, vicariously living through your kids? Tell me, I want to hear more about why you think that's a bad thing.
Well, I just think, to me, I think that's like you would end up projecting a lot. You would be like, don't you want to do this thing because I didn't get to do this thing.
Oh, I see.
You know,
right.
And like rather than.
Well, it's like I failed. I tried to be the, you know, head cheerleader at my high school and I couldn't do it. So now it's on you. Like, maybe you don't say that explicitly, but there's like the weight of those expectations.
Yeah. And I just don't want that for our kids.
But what if like I love their accomplishments and brag about them and make a huge deal out of them because I'm living through, like, you know what I mean?
I see what you mean.
Is there a good way of doing that? I don't know.
Yes, I think so.
And do you want to be friends with your kid? No, not too much.
You do, but you also want to be respected.
Right, that's what's happened with the dogs. I'm not just their friend. It's like I'm beneath them.
And you want them to be scared of you.
That's definitely, they're not scared of me. The dogs aren't scared of me.
I want them to be scared about how much they love me.
Yes! That's exactly it. I guess you don't have to get flea and tick medicine for kids, so it's probably a lot cheaper.
I woke Wyatt up like a couple days ago, and I was like, okay, so I figured out our 30-year plan.
Yeah, you're like wild-eyed. You're like, oh, by the way, last night I wrote out our 30-year plan. You're like, I'll share it with you now. Is it okay if I share it with you now?
Do you want to hear it
probably
now?
Later when you get home from work.
Do you want to wake up first?
And then you had just like a whole like year by year. In my mind, there were like emojis too. You're like baby number one, and there's like a little baby.
Baby number one,
like when you send me a grocery list.
Baby number five. No, and I think it's. I've always really liked to have a plan. Even if nothing goes according to plan, it's just, like, nice to have some sort of direction or to feel like, oh, there is so much time and there's also no time, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, there really is. Like, we have so much life to live and so much ahead of us.
We really do.
Like, it really is that Mary Oliver. Like, what are you going to do with your precious life?
With this wild, precious life,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And not don't enjoy it. Enjoy it.
Yeah.
And don't enjoy it.
I was going to say that you stumble on your words much. Well, you know what? All of this planning really takes a lot of trust.
Yeah.
I think we got a voicemail about trust. I don't know.
You did good.
I don't know. This is a beta test. We're testing.
Beta. Sorry. No, I'm not going to do that.
I'm leaving it.
No, because that's a bad reference. Okay.
Okay. I'm leaving it. And we are leaving this.
Hey, folks. It's Max. I think this hotline thing is such a cool idea. I'm continually in awe of the level of trust that you have with your fans and how open and accessible you've made your life to us. My question is, how do you decide what to share with us and what to keep private? And have you found that balance successful? I'd love to see a manic episode about trust. Trust as a celebrity, trust within relationships, trust within the community, trust while being queer, trust as a trauma survivor. I know for myself, being queer and mask presenting and also a survivor of a lot of traumas, I tend to navigate my world very carefully. And if I didn't have trust, I don't think I could do it. So how about an episode on building trust? Could be mutually beneficial. Thanks. Hugs to the doggos.
I am worried that the dogs are going to hear how much love and attention they are getting from our listeners. And they're going to get incrementally and apocalyptically worse and worse and worse.
They're going to start demanding.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to start demanding like royalties or whatever, yes. Like a cut of anything. Yeah. Well, joke's on you, dogs. There's nothing to give. No, I'm just kidding. Y'all support us so well. We're so, like, so spoiled.
We really are.
Yes. Okay, Max, longtime listener of the pod, loved that question.
Such and actually, a great question.
As you were talking about the relationship that we are sort of forming with the dogs, like, as parental figures and how that's going to carry forward, as we were talking about that, I was thinking, like, This requires a massive amount of trust in each other in order to, like, take this on together.
Yeah.
And so that's just, I don't know. I actually liked the connection is an organic one to me.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think that I've actually been thinking about this a lot lately, that part of my, I'm going to get real deep real fast.
Plunge us in, Daddy.
I think there's a reason that I haven't been married before and that I like to think that I'm an incredibly trusting individual. And I think that I am somebody where people feel trust in me, so they feel like they can really confide in me. But I think that I'm secretly incredibly distrustful. Like, I don't trust people.
Yeah.
Because I think that happens with, like, early childhood trauma. I think that happens with a lot of, like, you know, like, and bad positions.
Yeah, and I think, Max talked about that, too.
Like, exactly.
I think that's a relevant part of this, right?
Totally.
Yeah, as, like, being a survivor of trauma, as you are.
I have not really considered that maybe some of my past behaviors, I mean, as I've been doing, like, therapy to be like, oh, shit, there are a lot of behaviors that I have engaged in that are unhealthy relationship behaviors that I can really, like, I didn't used to be able to tie back to, like, trauma, but now that totally makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of those things is that I don't think that I would ever call anything that I ever did cheating. I never felt like I was cheating, but I'm definitely somebody that I would call it trapdoors. Like, I would, like, make sure that there's somebody in the wings.
Like there's somebody, an escape hatch.
Yeah, that, like, I'm, you know, I have some sort of, you know, emotional connection going on elsewhere where, like, if something goes wrong, I've got that. I know I can, like, everything's okay. And it doesn't mean that, like, I'm not, you know, invested in the relationship or something. It's a just in case, you know, connection.
Well, I absolutely relate to that. And you said something I think is really interesting, that it doesn't mean you're not invested in the relationship you're in. And I agree, having been in that position, it doesn't mean that, but it does mean something. There is a really interesting phenomenon in that arrangement that you didn't mention, that you have to have that kind of connection with somebody or you're like, you don't feel complete.
Yes.
Like, yeah. You, like that, that's something that, like, you're, I find that I have a, like, I've experienced this feeling of like a dependence on being wanted and loved.
Yes.
Like I need to have that.
Totally. But I mean, what I'm thinking is, like, in these relationships where I would do that, I felt chosen. I felt like that person wasn't going to leave me.
Oh, interesting.
But
yeah.
For me, it was like, I don't know if this is making, I don't know if I'm the happiest I'm ever going to be. Like,
you didn't trust your own. You didn't trust that it was the apex, the pinnacle of what you were looking for.
Totally. Right. And I think, like, I'm not proud of that behavior. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that it reflects a kind of distrust that, like, something might go wrong and I have to make sure that there's somebody there that's going to love me.
Right.
And there's going to be some relationship that I can turn to.
Right.
Because the idea of being alone is so, like, terrifying.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this the other night where I'm like, this is truly the first time where I've not had any trap doors, where I just fully trust you. And it's not just about trusting you, it's trusting this relationship.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's about. It was like, I trusted the people I was with, but I don't know that I trusted the relationship, but
yeah.
I trust this marriage. Like, I trust you.
Yeah. That's where I feel like I am able to be honest and vulnerable and forthright with you in a way that I've struggled to be in several of my previous relationships. It's because of some kind of a fear that I think comes from a lack of trust. But I know that we've talked about trust in relation to our, you know, as it pertains to our relationship a lot. But, like, I think what's interesting that Max was asking about is how we decide, like, what to share with people. Like, how do we decide what to share with? And I'm imagining that what Max means by that is, like, people who listen to the podcast. Like, how do we decide what to share in our lives? And for me, it is I have to be, like, 100% sure, first of all, that it's not going to endanger me or my wife or my dogs or my home in any way. So as long as I'm completely certain of that.
Sorry, you said wife.
Sorry. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds good.
I think that's the first time I've said that on this podcast.
That's so cool.
I probably said it on the last episode. I don't know. that it's not going to, like, put me or anybody that I love in danger. That's the first, obviously. So I don't trust so much that I'm willing to, like, put myself in any kind of weird danger. And secondly, that I think it's going to be either helpful for somebody or make somebody laugh or, you know, cheer somebody up or, you know, like, enrich somebody's life in some way. So I have to feel like there's some kind of, like, a payoff to the vulnerability, you know?
Mm, yeah.
And, like, for example, I wouldn't share – I'm going to be much more upfront in my job about – like, I did a panel – a faculty and staff panel about disability a few weeks ago and talked, you know, like did a panel discussion about having bipolar disorder in a way that if I didn't feel as secure in my position, I wouldn't have done. So, you know, like, I don't know if I would have felt that comfortable sharing that openly before getting tenure.
Right.
So,
right.
I decided, like, first of all, I feel safe and secure, so I'm not putting myself or my family or anybody in danger by sharing that. And secondly, I felt confident it was going to be beneficial for someone, that it wasn't just me, like, venting or letting off steam or, you know, something like that. I have to feel like there's some kind of payoff. And then for me, it's all worth it.
Right.
The trust is, you know, I trust. I don't have, like, blanket trust for all of humanity. I definitely don't. Mm-hmm. So I am guarded in my own way.
I think we're both really hitting on something that I hadn't really thought of, but like, you can't trust unless you feel safe.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you have to have an element of safety in order to do those things.
Or evidence that it's going to be okay.
Yeah,
like, evidence
exactly.
that, like, you can do it and the person won't, you know, that they will still be there for you afterwards.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's true. I think that's a good point.
I think the... We were talking about... Sorry. Like, clawing you with my nails. The other night when... Ooh, do you want to talk about... This is very interesting.
Depends on what it is.
Do you want to talk about what we were talking about the other night? About... that experience we had by the trash can.
Oh, yeah. I would love to. Oh, my gosh, yes. So Mary just decided that she was just, like, so randy one night that she just, like, could not wait till we got home. So she was like...
What? What the
fuck? Just kidding. She was like, no, it was this one night that she was like, oh, fuck, where's my retainer? And I was like, what are you talking about? She was like, I think I accidentally threw it away. We had to dig. Is that the trash can story? Just kidding.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay. We don't have to talk about it.
No. Interestingly, I wrote this. Okay, I'm being earnest now. I wrote this in my vows. And I removed it as I was reading them. I decided not to say it because, speaking of trust and vulnerability, I was being really open in my vows about, like, our relationship and about the fact that, like, we went to couples counseling, you know, only a few weeks into our relationship, that we both have bipolar disorder. Like, it really felt important to me to sort of commemorate that. But I took this out because I was like, I've already been naked enough in these vows, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna put my shawl on now, but is that I don't know if I've talked about this on podcast or not. I picked up secretly my little cigarette smoking habit a few years ago. When I met Mary, I had been smoke free for a few years. And it's not because Mary smoked cigarettes.
But I was smoking cigarettes.
Well, Mary was smoking, but, like, I told Mary, and I really meant this, I was, like, one stressful situation away from buying a pack of cigarettes at all times. So it was really only a matter of time before that happened. Like, it's really important that you know that. Like, you're not responsible for my choices ever. That's just not how life works. Unless you, like, physically were like, hey, guess what? I got you hooked on cigarettes again by, like, putting a lit cigarette in your mouth while you were asleep or something. Like, that's not, you know what I mean?
Okay.
But so, I, and Mary found out about it. I remember I was at the grocery store and you were looking for something in the closet and found a pack of cigarettes. And you were, like, obviously and clearly disappointed. I could tell. I remember, like, driving home from the grocery store and I was just so fucking nervous because I was like, okay, I'm going to go home and I have to talk to you about this, right? And it was, like, a few months into the pandemic and, like, it was super stressful. And also my cigarette of choice were menthols and it was, like, menthol or bust. Like, I did not want any non-menthol cigarette, and menthol cigarettes are illegal in Massachusetts mm-hmm. now. So I was having to, like, clandestinely drive to fucking Connecticut to get them. So it was like, it was one of those things where, like, I simultaneously felt terrified that I had been found out, but also really relieved that I didn't have to hide it anymore, you know? Mm. And so I remember being so nervous driving home, but I felt really confident that what I had heard in your voice was, like, your primary feeling was that you were sad that I hadn't told you. Like, you were sad. Well, I guess that's obvious. Like, you were sad that I hadn't felt safe telling you that.
Yeah.
That was what it was. Yeah. It wasn't anger. It was like, oh, fuck, I wish you felt like you could have told me that, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't immediately even, like, cop to it. It took a while. And I really do feel like addictive substances are their own sort of unique trigger for me in terms of, like, being able to be honest mm-hmm. about what's going on. And so, but I also knew, like, oh, this is something I really need to work through. Like, this is something I need to talk about. Like, I clearly can't do this by myself. And, like, it took us all day of talking about it. Mm-hmm. But then eventually, Mary, I was like, I'm ready to quit. Like, I'm done. I'm ready to quit smoking. Like, I'm done forever. Like, I'm really done forever now. And we'd been talking about it and working through it like all day, you know? And so, I was like, cold turkey, I'm done with this. And Mary walked down to the trash can.
Showed me where all of your stashes were. And I was just like, this is such a humbling thing to do. Like, I know how much this is taking for you to do. And to me, like, it was just like a really true display of trust and honesty. Like, it just felt good.
I'm really glad that you felt that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could compare the pain of, like, realizing that somebody's been dishonest with you about that with, like, the pain of being found out, but they're each their own kind of pain, you know? And the pain of, like, having violated your trust. But I remember I was like, and you were like, if you need to keep smoking, like, I get it. Like, you know, we can talk about it, like, if you want to. And I was like, no, I don't want to. And you were like, well, maybe if it, you know, you can take your time, like, you know, if you want to do like nicotine gum or patches, or like if it takes you a while, that's okay. And I was like, no, I appreciate that, but I think it's best if I just completely part ways with this, right? So I was like, I'm gonna go throw my last pack away, and you went with me to throw stuff away, and you're like holding my hand, and you're like, I'm really proud of you, and I know we can do this. And I learned, like, in that moment, I was like, I don't ever have to hide anything like this again, because there's no punishment. There were no consequences. The only person I was hurting in that dynamic was myself, and making life exponentially harder for myself than it needed to be. And you, by having to have this experience of finding it out and be like, why wouldn't you just tell me? Like, of course you can trust me. Just tell me, you know?
Yeah.
And so I remember in that moment feeling like, I don't have to do this anymore. Like, I don't have to do this again. And, like, secret smoking has been an unfortunate part of many of my relationships because it's so shameful. And inevitably what would happen is something stressful would happen, and I would, like, I was having an out-of-body experience. I wouldn't even realize what was happening, and I'd be in the store buying a pack of cigarettes. And then I'd be like, well, I can't admit it. It's too painful to admit this. And it then becomes a thing, so I'm just going to hide this. And unfortunately, Mary has a little genetic situation that makes it really easy to hide it from her because she doesn't have a sense of smell. So, like, the only evidence, but, like, it's so fucking annoying to look back at, like, or to hear, like, recordings of my voice from that time. And, like, my voice sounded like shit. Like, I clearly was, like it's not good. It wasn't good for me, you know? And I told you, I remember I was like, I don't feel like I'm getting away with something. Like, I actually hate this. Like, this is really unpleasant. Yeah. And I don't feel like this is something that's, like, super fun and sneaky that I get to do. And I get to have my cake and eat it, too. I was like, I hate this, you know? So you became a co-conspirator with me. Like, I just reoriented it so that I was like, this is my teammate. Like, this is the love of my life. Like, this is, there's nothing that I have to hide from you for fear of consequences.
Totally.
Like, it's just, it's us. Yeah. It's me, you know? And so that way you weren't my, like, enforcer. You were like, you know, I saw you as what you are, which is you're my teammate.
Totally. I don't know if I've told you about this, but I experienced a similar situation with a previous relationship on the other end, where I told the person I was with that I had been secretly smoking, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life. It was, like, a really, really just frustrating conversation and really just dehumanizing, and it didn't make me feel safe, and it didn't make me feel like I had someone on my team. And I remembered that feeling being like, there's a reason that I'm scared to tell you things. Like, when you have a reaction that's so explosive or so angry or so, like, you know, I think it is important that we, like, you know, manage our own emotions when people are doing a difficult thing and being honest with
us. It's really hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because it's like, wow, I feel really betrayed. But it is really such a gift when someone is being honest with you about something that's difficult.
I am ashamed to say, you know what's coming up for me as you're talking about this? I know I've shared this with you, but I don't think I've shared this on the pod before. Is I know exactly what you're talking about that needing to have grace while somebody's sharing something painful. Because in a previous relationship of mine, my then partner
I knew that this person had had problems with, like, a particular self-harming behavior in the past, but had, for what I understood, was sort of in recovery from it, right? And I found out in the process of our relationship was engaging in this behavior secretly. And I, at first, was like, I want to do everything I can to support you. Like, I'm really sad that you didn't tell me about this, but, like, I want to support you, and I want to love you, and I want this to be okay. I love you. Sorry, not I want to love you. Freudian slip there. That relationship was not great for either one of us. But, and then, though, a bad thing happened in my brain where, like, the more time went on, I didn't grow in grace. I kept turning it over in my mind and finding new things to be angry about. So I never really forgave, which I guess means I didn't really understand. Mm. I didn't put the work into understanding. So as I kept, like, you know, it's like when you keep turning something over and over in your brain and you feel more reasons to be angry about it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, totally.
So I kept stewing on it. So, like, after saying, oh my God, you know, all is forgiven, I love you, this is not about me, this is about you, then I was like, you know, it really is kind of shitty that I didn't know about that. Mm. Like, that was a really shitty thing for you to not tell me about. And, like, I kept digging into it. And so, yeah, you're right. Like, that's a situation where I should have humbled myself to that experience. But that was just, like, a really selfish, knee-jerk response to it. Totally. 'Cause, you know, it wasn't about me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't even occur to me, like, what would I have hoped for in this situation? Because I've been on the other side of that situation, like, you know, being secretive and hiding things since time immemorial in my relationships in some way or another, you know? But you're right, the best way to, like, demonstrate that trust is to be like, look here, the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
Like, because everybody's going to fuck up. Yeah. Like, inevitably. And, totally. Like, I think in every relationship there's something that you are reluctant to share because you're not proud of it, right?
Yeah, whether totally. It's like,
you know, doing something that you know your partner would be disappointed in you doing, or, you know, like spending money in a way your partner wouldn't be comfortable with, or whatever. Like, there's always going to be those little things. Mm-hmm. And I think you can demand honesty all day and all night, but like you said, I think the best way is just to be like, see, I'm a soft place to land. Like, you can tell me nothing bad's going to happen.
Totally. And I think what's difficult is, like, can you offer that softness and also have respect for yourself and have your own boundaries?
Yeah.
You know, to be like, well, this is also not, this is a line for me, or this is, you know, like, so this, in some ways, it's like sometimes maybe that's not the case for people. But I think, at least for myself, when it comes to substances, I'm like, I just don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know, yeah. Like, I guess my experience with substances, I feel like, has really informed my relationship to them not being shameful.
Yes.
And that, like, shame is the worst possible thing that can happen in those experiences. And, like, it wouldn't be a deal breaker for me if you were, you know, like, if that's what you needed to do, or it was more difficult for you, like, I would be there, you know, no matter what. And it's just not, it wasn't difficult.
I fucking love you. And there's no, it's not an accident that, like, I have been able to live as fully and as, like, richly in this experience of being sober in this relationship with you.
Same. I think the honest, like, the safety comes first, then you have trust, and then honesty, I think, can come with all of those things, you know?
Yep.
Hi, I'm Daphna, longtime listener of the pod, and I'm calling in to say that today I'm 6 months alcohol-free. I wanted to thank both of you for introducing me to This Naked Mind and Annie Grace's thoughts and work on this. My life has improved so much over the last 6 months, and I couldn't have done it without the inspiration you both provided me. So thank you.
Oh, you started crying when I played you that message from Daphna.
That's really, really sweet.
She's crying again. Waterworks.
The donkey sound.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Or is it an emergency sound?
Yeah, it was like supposed to be like a siren, but I think I'm thinking about the donkey that we met on Thanksgiving at that farm. Her name was Alice. But yeah, tell me where the tears are coming from.
I don't know. It's like, your relationship to quitting drinking is really powerful and infectious in a good way. And I feel like it's so bonkers to me that I haven't had a drink in like a year and a half. And I remember I was telling some a few friends of mine who have been, you know, long time like AA people, you know, 20 years sober, and it's like very, you know, their sobriety is very important to them, and you know, they talk about it a lot, and I know that it's been somewhat of a struggle, and just hearing from them, I think sometimes the narrative that you get around sobriety is that it's like incredibly difficult.
And I think,
you know,
for a lot of people, it really is. Yeah.
And actually, I did this podcast where the host was talking about sobriety and addiction. And for me, I feel like I just don't, there are so many things to be ashamed of in the world. And for me, a lot of those like things that are stigmatized are huge triggers. And so I have done as much work as I possibly can to destigmatize those for myself and hopefully unlock that for other people as well in my like public life. And for me, addiction is one of those things that I think people, it becomes this like barrier to them. It becomes like this anvil of shame,
yeah,
within that's like, I am a broken person.
Right.
And there's something about me that's just inherently bad.
Well, yeah. And that's often, like, I think, part of the 12-step process.
Yeah.
Right?
Is like,
not the anvil, but no, yeah, that
but
idea.
I don't know how you can get to this place where you're like, I deserve to feel good all the time and I deserve peace, but I'm at the core of who I am, I'm a broken, addictive person.
You know,
like, I'm sorry. I feel like that's a very Calvinist.
That's what, like, I was just gonna fucking say.
It's like, it is. It's puritanical. It's like, yeah. Like, the only pure good thing is God.
Yeah.
And I am shit. I am actual poop shit.
Yeah,
and everything I do is poopy shit.
I'm reading this book right now called The Ruin of All Witches by Malcolm something that starts with a G. And it is
not set, Gladwell.
Yeah, no, not Gladwell. It's set in fucking sorry. It's set in like the 1600s in Springfield, Massachusetts. So it in our near area of the woods ish, and fuck. Okay, sorry. I'm so eloquent tonight. shit, I can do this. Hold on, no, this is, I'm training myself out of ADHD. I can remember what I was talking about. And okay, just give me a second. I'm not going to edit this out. This is accountability. This is accountability politics. Okay, shit. Yes. It was talking about this guy, Malcolm G, not Gladwell, some other guy, was talking about, he wasn't talking, he was writing.
Wow.
I'm going on like 2.5 minutes of this. Please just have, I need to land the plane here, okay?
Why are you looking at me like that?
So, the religious motherfuckers who settled were all Calvinists, and there was this sort of theological shift that was about to happen in this time period where people went from understanding Christ's crucifixion in one particular way to another. The old Calvinist way of understanding the crucifixion was very different than our current understanding in, like, Christian theology, which holds that Christ died in order to unburden mankind of their sins,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, that it was a sacrifice.
Yeah, and he knew it was, he was like, I know.
Yep, knew that he was making that sacrifice, yes, and that God basically, like, allowed that sacrifice to sort of, like, fulfill, you know,
the sins of man.
Right, yeah, right, to absolve those sins, right? Mm-hmm. Or that Christ died for those sins. The Calvinist view held that Christ's death was that of a vengeful God who was, like, punishing
not only Christ, but like also mankind. Like that was not like a loving sacrifice. That was like the act of like a fiery punitive God.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was like the whole idea behind like, you know, these like Calvinists and these other like super religious people like wearing the hair shirts and all that shit was like that God did not want you to be happy. Like that was not one of God's priorities. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was like just the opposite. You should be like fucking terrified of God. And if you happen to be happy, that's great. But like, that's not necessarily what you need to do. Like, and that, you know, like being alive is like fire and suffering and hardship and loss and death. And that like, you know, like you might achieve salvation through like accepting Christ, but that basically God fucking hates you. And like, I mean, there is like, of course, like the scripture stayed the same. But anyway, that was like the prevailing sort of view was of a vengeful God bent on punishment. And like, I think there is a little bit, I think you're right, of that sort of like Calvinist understanding of like, this is fire and brimstone and suffering. Yeah. And like, you need to accept that you're like fundamentally flawed and sinful and that you carry this maladaptive kind of trait, or really I think they sort of cast it as like almost like a genetic inheritance of like failure, like and that you have to, I could have probably gotten here without the
because it's super interesting because I think it stems from that same sort of belief, and I think a lot of the 12-step programs stem from that kind of belief that like there is something like addiction doesn't affect everybody the same way, which is true. But addiction, it's like we've totally stripped all of the substance out of it. I'm like, no, these substances are addictive.
Yes, true.
These substances are addictive.
Yes, and Annie Grace as Daphna, shout out Daphna, 6 months. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
And in fact, sidebar, when I guess it's not really a sidebar because I'm like talking to like this is the only channel I went back and was looking at some of my little notes from the app that I use, that I Am Sober app, from around the 6 month mark, and I think that's like a really special point in a journey with like being alcohol free because I think it becomes like It's part of your life. It's not like you're sort of moving in rather than just being like a tourist. Yeah. And you're like, what does this look for me? What does this look like for me? Like, because you've started to enjoy so many of the benefits that you're like, fuck, like what else is possible, you know? But, so yeah, 6 months is a huge deal. And so Daphna well knows that Annie Grace is really explicit in This Naked Mind about alcohol being an addictive substance, like that she goes into like a lot of detail and a lot of research about like you will develop a physical dependency on alcohol because it is designed to make you physically addicted to it. Or like smoking. I mean, that's what caused me to absolve myself of a lot of the guilt that I felt around starting to smoke again is like it's one of the, it's what's that line? It's like, if you use it properly, it kills you and you get addicted to it. Like that's what it's designed to get you addicted to it. Totally. Like that's what it is.
Yeah. And I think the thing with alcohol too is like, yes, there are plenty of people that have a healthy relationship with alcohol, and you know, maybe it doesn't have the same sort of chemicals that it does, that you know, cigarettes do, but there is this cultural like blanket acceptance for binge drinking, for this kind of drinking that is just so constant and sexy and it's everywhere.
Yeah.
So like, I think to me, I can look at the culture and say like, oh, this isn't something that's just wrong with me. It's not like I have some sort of chip missing that I can't, you know, it's like, oh, it's around me in my environment. And even if it wasn't just the culture, maybe it has to do with the, you know, like being a bartender, being around it, you know, like there are just so many other factors,
right?
Besides being just like, you know, inherently like addictive,
right? Absolutely, know? Yes. You're right. There are so many different moving parts, like you know, that it's not just how physiologically addicting a substance might be, but it's how like culture, how is the culture sort of set up to sustain the availability of that substance and it being like constantly in your face and made to look super appealing.
Yes. Right? And then you have substances that are like, you know, like heroin or like things that are like,
cocaine,
you know, like actually chemically addictive.
Right.
You know,
but alcohol
is as well. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
But I feel like in smaller amounts, you know, it's not the same.
Right.
But I don't know. So I just think that we're not talking about it the way that we should. What I don't, when I talk to people that say they have, that saying they have an addiction gives them a sense of freedom, I can appreciate that for them, but I just, for me, it has always felt like a source of shame. I'm like, I don't need another mar on my, list of
shameful titles,
you know?
Right, yeah.
Like, I'd rather not.
Yeah.
But
people are really, a lot of people though, if they have sort of like, if that is what has worked for them, mm-hmm. if that kind of system, like, cause I think if you can catch somebody before if they don't need that way of thinking about it, if you can catch them before they enter it, you know, and can like divert them to another route, I think Annie Grace's route is much kinder and gentler.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's already worked for them, there's real resistance to like rejecting that label. Like, I think, oh fuck, you think you can just get away with like, not accepting this about yourself? Like, I had to do it.
Yeah.
You feel like you don't have to do that? Like, I can see there being some resistance to that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think what happens is that, like, oh, if I'm always going to be an addict, I just feel like the relationship around sobriety feels really tenuous, and it feels like it's just kind of teetering on the edge, and whoever knows.
Yeah.
And then like, I feel like then relapses happen and the whole shame cycle comes back,
yeah.
you know? And like, it bums me out. I really feel for people that continually go to AA or feel like it's the only, or NA, or it's the only thing that there is, but there's other shit out there,
you know,
that could work for you if AA doesn't work.
I think you're right. And I think there is some small element of like, I got sober, you know, uphill in the snow both ways.
Mm.
And so what if you're just going the easy route?
Yeah.
Like if you don't go through this whole process, then you haven't really accepted or enacted like what it means to really be sober, because I think there is like a trial by fire kind of element of it, you know what I mean?
Mm.
I think like that's like there is that perception, but I think whatever the hell works for you, because none of that other shit had worked for me, period. And like, it's something I just like sort of kept returning to. Also, this is another thing about that sort of like the prevailing discourse around sobriety really was a turn off to me. I don't even like the term sobriety. And mm-hmm. I think, in fact, Daphna's voicemail, she said, like, I'm 6 months alcohol free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what I prefer to do. And we've talked about this before, about like the fact that we both still use cannabis products too, makes mm-hmm. me feel a little disingenuous about saying that, mm-hmm. using that word sober. So I, even though like that's the only thing that I do, I still just, I don't know. I there's like the purity insinuated by that is just not something I super resonate with.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I think a lot of the discourse around sobriety suggests that in order to find it, you have to have plummeted to the lowest possible depths.
Yes.
And even when telling my family members and friends that I quit drinking, I could tell them faces, they're like, I didn't even know you had a problem with it. And like, mm-hmm. it's like, if you are not absolutely rock bottom, whatever that means for you, then it won't really ever stick. Or like, you can't make your way there voluntarily. Or like, I don't know. I just always thought like, I must not have that much of a problem with it. I always just felt like I didn't have enough of a problem with it, whatever that meant, to justify pursuing any kind of not drinking.
Totally.
So that's what really resonated with me as well about Annie's book, is that she was like, could get away with living life that way, you know, forever if she wanted to.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people are that way.
Totally.
And, you know, are just made miserable in a few ways that they can sort of handle
uh-huh.
by drinking. So,
yes.
Yeah, that's another thing. It just didn't. And I know, like, you know, Daphne is an incredibly successful human being. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she has every message around her telling her, like, why is this bad? Why would you stop?
I also wonder about the overlap between people that are high functioning with, like, mental illness and people that, you know, are high functioning with dealing with substance issues. Because you sort of, like, we're really good at, like, everything's fine, and, you know, it's like the iceberg, you know, like, yeah, there's a bunch of shit going on underneath.
Yes.
And I think for me, when I was drinking, it was like, I'm fine, everything's fine. You know, these memories I would have of, like, all I remember is I was working at the bar, and then I woke up at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, I didn't shut down the bar. And then running across the street and being like, the bar got shut down impeccably well. And I was like, I did that.
Right. So you're clearly I'm doing this. It's working.
I can handle this. So I haven't hit rock bottom because I'm clearly shutting the bar down fine. And I'm like, I don't know what happened because I blacked out. But looks like I'm fine. Yep. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I guess I can keep doing this thing. But the other thing I wanted to touch on was that not this last weekend I was in, I don't remember. New York? I don't know when it was. I was so drunk. No, I'm just kidding. I was in New York for 1946, the film that I composed the music for. We debuted at the
Doc NYC. Baby. And the biggest film festival, the biggest documentary film festival in the world.
And we broke some records, which is very exciting.
You broke the record. Do you like I'm interrupting you, Brag? It is the most viewed film in the history of the festival, 1946 is. It's a awesome mistranslation that shifted a culture. And they won the audience award.
And I think you can still watch it. If we get this out tomorrow, it will be, you could still watch it for one more day going to Doc NYC's website. Anyway, this is not the point of the story. The point of the story is that we were in New York and we went out to a bar afterwards and, you know, I want every mocktail. I'm fine. I just want to hang. Excited.
It's just a good hang. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like making a joke or something at dinner. Oh, and at dinner we had the best dinner and there was like a bunch of like non-alcoholic, like sparkling, you know, situations. Cute. Which I was like, oh my God. And it's in a wine glass and just was very nice.
It makes you feel very grown up.
Yes.
Sophisticated. No, I'm serious.
Yeah, right? Totally. Yeah, I felt sophisticated. I felt like I could, you know, it made me feel included. And that's what you want. But I like to make jokes a lot, like about being, you know, about not drinking. But I think it makes people uncomfortable. Like, I think a lot of people are really challenged by what that means. And so, like, I'll be at dinner and I'll be like, oh, no, maybe I'm going to break my sobriety tonight. like, oh, don't say something upsetting because I might start drinking. And people you know? Are like,
are you okay? Yeah. Is everything okay?
Like, or, like, we would joke about, like, oh, I think we're going to get a divorce.
Yes! Tonight, you know? And we make jokes like that all the time, but then when we took it on the road, people were like, oh, shit, all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I said something. I was teaching the other day, and I made a joke. I was like, oh, you know, don't tell my wife that. I might end up getting a divorce. And I heard this, like, group of three or four students go, oh, my God. They're like, don't say that. I was like, sorry, folks. You know what I mean? The old ball and chain. Take my wife, please.
I think that people don't normally joke about those kind of things.
You're right.
You know? And I think we do because we're comfortable with them.
And we're sick and twisted.
And fucked up.
And we're edgy.
And we're sick.
And fucked up.
And twisted.
And we're edgy.
And new. That's the new beginning of the podcast. Welcome to the new sick, twisted,
sick, strange world.
But I think we're comfortable with it, and it's playful. I mean, it's like we say it all the time. Like, if something like very mildly wrong happens, I'll be like, I'm gonna kill myself. And like, we don't. But like,
and then I realize, like, we say once again, we take that show on the road, and people don't like it.
No, and I get it, but I think it's a way to make scary things less scary.
100%. Well, in some instances, because to me, like, talking about getting a divorce, I'm not, like, first of all, I mean, we've only been married for a month, so I haven't had time to make those jokes very often. But I'm not scared of that. Yeah. I think it's just because it's so, like, it's so extreme and ridiculous.
Yes, that's what it is.
But with the other stuff, like, with mental health stuff, or, like, if I call myself crazy or something like that, which, by the way, I defend to the death my right to do if I'm talking about myself and if I'm not in mixed company, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's a way for me, that's a release valve for me. Like, 100%. I completely agree. Mm-hmm. And, like, people also who are really, really close to me, like, when I'm with my, intimate family members, and they'll even joke about something like that, it makes me feel comfortable, because I'm like, oh, they feel comfortable enough with me to joke with me about it. Totally. I really like that. But I think it doesn't really serve that same function for everybody. Yes. You know?
But I think that's what's so great about humor. Like, I think humor can be really disarming, and I think it's like, for us, it's just like, you're spot on. It's about it being an extreme, and that's why it's funny.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And then I feel safe going to those extremes. Because, like, there have definitely been relationships where I would not have joked about, like, breaking up. Yeah. Or, like, you know, it just would not have been funny.
Yeah, that's true.
It would have been too close to home. You know what I mean? Let's do something.
Let's do something wild. Something we've never done before.
But it's also, like, slipping into something a little bit more comfortable. Let's talk about our obsessions.
I'm going to get in a negligee.
Oh, my God. I'm going to get in a lot of trouble if you do that. What's your first obsession?
My first obsession is...
unprepared much?
Watching The Vow. Okay, so...
Fuck, I'm so sad it's over.
I did another podcast. I forget who... I recorded an episode with Queer Theology.
Oh, which
I'm really excited about that podcast. And they were like, what is the last thing that made you really happy? And the thing I answer is like, oh, I've really been loving, like, getting high with my spouse and watching The Vow. And and I'm like, I guess maybe this was not the right answer.
How did they react?
They were like, oh, okay.
They're like, are you okay?
But you know what I love about it is, like, my favorite thing to do with you is, like, this mix of, like, lowbrow, highbrow. And The Vow isn't quite like that because it's not reality TV. But it's, like, I just love spending time with you, period. But we just talk all the time.
Constantly.
Constantly. And I feel like when we've been watching The Vow, which is, if you don't know, it's a documentary about Keith Raniere and NXIVM and this cult.
It was, like, masquerading as, like, a self-improvement, you know, a company that offered classes and different levels and all of this. But it really was just sort of like a vehicle for this guy, Keith Raniere's, like, sexual exploitation, basically. And, like, super manipulative, abusive relationships. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it has just been so, like, I mean, it's terrible. The show, I mean, it's like what's happening in it is terrible. It's
awful, yeah.
But, like, being able to pause, like, every 20 minutes and discuss things. And we did that, too, with Love is Blind, which was another
thing we
both got obsessed with.
Love is Blind was an electric factory. Mary, like, stayed up all night watching the first few episodes, and then you stayed up again all night watching the rest of them.
Yes.
And then I got sucked in, and it was just absolutely rapid fire, electric factory, so good.
It's just one of my favorite things to do is like watch these shows with you and just pause and discuss and analyze, and it's just so fun.
It really is. And, like, we'll end up having these conversations about our own relationships and our own experiences and our own hopes and dreams. And actually, it was on the heels of, do you remember that I read that study about how when couples watch shows having to do with relationships and talk about them, I think it was talking specifically about, like, fictional relationships in movies and TV shows, but I imagine the same thing applies, that's a marker of the relationships, that's correlated with the longevity of relationships. So it's good for a relationship to talk about stuff like that.
Totally, because I think you get to be like, what would you do in that situation, or how would you feel in that situation?
Yeah,
you
know? Right. Or, and, like, talk about experiences with other partners, or, you know, other triggers, or, you know, interactions with, like, how did your family think about this when they met your loved one, or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I just love it. So The Vow, got super obsessed with. Also, it was just a really well done documentary.
It really was.
It was a part, I don't know how many part series on.
It was actually a So there are two seasons, and I think each season was like 5 or 6 episodes.
Yeah.
You know, an hour a piece on HBO. I always feel like it's a marker of a really good, you know, that documentary series, The Staircase, also did this, where it's so slick and well-produced that the actual players feel like they were cast. Like, it feels like they're, like, really intentionally cast in those roles. Like, that kind of thing happens, where, you know, the line between, like, reality and fiction is blurred in a really interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it.
So that's my obsession.
I will say, I am reading Maggie Haberman's book about Trump. It's called Confidence Man. And I cannot believe that these words are coming out of my mouth. I messaged our dear friend Leslie about this. I was talking about how this book is going. I can't believe I'm saying this, given the subject matter, like, given the person that this book is about. But I feel like she's not totally fair. Like, I don't know if she's capable of being fair about the subject, which I understand, because, like, while she, you know, she was, like, a staff reporter for the New York Times, who's, like, basically, like, assigned to Trump since the days of the Republican primary back in 2016. So she's so close to him. And also, he has, like, shit on her on Twitter so many times and has been, like, the subject of so many of his personal insults. Like, I understand, but it just feels to me like not a totally, like, clear-headed analysis of what's happened. So it's interesting in that respect, but anyway, so that's good. That The Ruin of All Witches book that I'm reading is also really good. What else? Oh, What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, yes.
I love that show. Thank you to everybody who's recommended that to me, primarily my sister and her husband. It's so funny. And everybody keeps telling us we have to watch the movie.
I know, but I'm too attached to the TV show.
Me too.
I feel like the movie's just going to disappoint me.
I only want these characters.
Yeah, and they're like, it's different characters. I'm like, well, then I don't want to see it because I like these characters.
And then I love my sister to pieces. She dropped a big-ass spoiler.
I know, Joy!
During lunch. But Joy. She was also like, well, I mean, you knew it was coming. And I was like, not really.
No, I didn't know.
But I just, like, you know what? Joy just famously sort of does that. And, like, I remember seeing The Sixth Sense with her. I think I've told this story before. Mm-mm. And it was, like, 20 minutes into it. And she, like, turned to me and she was like, I feel like Bruce Willis's character is dead. She's like, it's so obvious.
Wait, and she hadn't seen it?
No, she had not seen it. But really Joy is like my sister is like incredibly perceptive and intuitive, and sometimes that's fun, and then sometimes she ruins movies and TV shows. But no, I love you, Joy. If you even still listen to this. I think that's about it for my obsessions. Am I forgetting anything? Perennially obsessed with Orange Theory.
Yeah.
Still. Love it. No free ads. However, I am member of the month at my local Orange Theory Fitness right now. My reign is ending in a few days. I don't want to talk about it.
I understand.
I've thought about refusing to relinquish the throne. Like, they can wrestle this title from my cold, dead hands.
You also dealt with some neck pain this week.
God bless. I really did. I don't know what's causing it, y'all, but I just know that I'm getting old and I'll sleep funny and then not be able to move my neck for 3 days. But
yeah, back on season 1, I think we talked about it during the pain episode.
Pain episode, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it happened again, but honestly not nearly as bad as it did that first time. And I got a massage from Pat Bowden in Northampton, Massachusetts, by the way. I will say, go and see her if you are anywhere in the Pioneer Valley area.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
You were raving.
Yeah.
And I have not had mine yet, so I'm excited.
That's right. My mom got us gift cards, and you need to go. You need to go get yours.
I know.
But I know that it's going to be... I told her, I was like, my wife needs to come in here, but she will always arrange things for me and prioritize me, and she will not take care of herself. You need to put your own oxygen mask on, girl.
Well, I have been washing my feet.
Wash your face, girlfriend.
Which honestly has been like... It's not an obsession, but I'm like... Since the wedding happened, I'm like, okay, what do I do now? Like,
fixate on?
What needs my attention? I'm like, oh, myself. Like,
yeah.
So I stretched this morning.
Good.
And I've been dealing with, I don't know if other fat people deal with this or people who, I don't know. I don't think it's just a fat thing, but I think it is, it affects fat people a lot more. Dealing with dry feet and then cracked feet.
Yeah.
And then so, like, that has been really painful.
I think that also comes with just getting older.
Yeah. But it's, like, first thing in the morning just being like, that really hurts.
Poor
so
baby.
But I thrash my feet, and I wear flats a lot, so I don't wear socks. And anyway, my feet probably smell like shit, so...
So I'm trying to be more hygienic.
They really don't, though.
I appreciate that.
I'm not just saying that. Like, you're always like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. My feet smell so foul. I'm like, you, girlfriend, you're fucking nuts. You don't have a sense of smell and you don't know. And I don't smell them. So
I don't know. I don't know who to trust.
Did you really just say that to me?
I do trust you. It's just having been on tour with people who just repeatedly are like, yeah, your feet smell bad. Your maybe feet just constantly smell bad. I think they don't smell bad to you.
Maybe I'm just either nose blind to you, or I just love you so much. Or I'm lying. That's always, I mean, no, I wouldn't be able to. I'm so sensitive to smells.
Yeah.
You've seen me.
Well, that's why I think my feet pheromones really do it for you.
Actually. Any other obsessions?
No.
Do you have a poem to read?
I do. Do you want me to go first?
What else do you think I'm doing this for?
Wow.
No, please do, honey.
About to read another lie. I was like, I can't find it. I can only find this lie.
Big surprise.
Okay.
I'm excited to hear your poem.
This is a poem called Love After Love by Derek Wolcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life.
Oh, that's really beautiful.
Isn't that pretty?
Where was that when I went through my last breakup?
Honestly, same.
Really good.
Rachel McKibbins posted it.
Did she?
Yeah.
Love her, too. I can't believe we've had her on the pod.
I know.
Lucky, lucky, lucky.
Lucky, lucky.
I found, this is kind of a cheesy poem, but I really like it.
I love cheese.
I just loved this. I just thought there was something about this that was just, okay. This is by Jane Kenyon. This is written in, like, the late 80s,
from
I think.
From Kenyon...
What?
Press?
No, it's not.
Oh.
Oh, you mean, like, Kenyon Review or whatever?
Yeah. Never mind.
Look, I was quiet while you read yours.
I'm sorry.
It might be. By Jane Kenyon of the Kenyon Review Press. This is called After an Illness, Walking the Dog. Wet things smell stronger, and I suppose his main regret is that he can sniff just one at a time. In a frenzy of delight, he runs way up the sandy road, scored by freshets after 5 days of rain. Yeah. Every pebble gleams, every leaf. While I whistle, he halts abruptly and steps in a circle, swings his extravagant tail. Then he rolls and rubs his muzzle in a particular place while the drizzle falls without cease. And Queen Anne's lace and goldenrod bend below. The top of the logging road stands open and light. Another day before hunting starts, we'll see how far it goes, leaving word first at home. The footing is ambiguous. Soaked and muddy, the dog drops, panting, and looks up with what amounts to a grin. It's so good to be uphill with him, nicely winded and looking down on the pond. A sound commences in my left ear, like the sound of the sea in a shell. A downward, vertiginous drag comes with it. Time to head home. I wait until we're nearly out to the main road to put him back on the leash, and he, the designated optimist, imagines to the end that he is free.
Oh my
my God, that feels like us.
Doesn't it?
That feels like our girls.
That's just what a hike
feels like with them.
I completely agree.
Wow.
It reminded me a lot. I love
Designated Optimist, too.
It reminded me of my, I did too. It reminded me of going on a walk with them after when I was like starting to feel better from COVID.
Yeah.
It was really nice. I just really liked it. Well, folks, as they say at the end of some things, that's all we got for you.
And just a reminder, if you want to call in and leave us a message,
we won't tell you what to say.
Yeah, give us a thought. You know, like Max and Daphna basically like steered this whole podcast. So
honestly, yes, Max and Daphna steered this whole podcast. So and y'all do the same. Ask us a question, tell us your story, challenge us, say something. We love you telling us how amazing we are, so that's always welcome, but we want to hear other stuff from you, too.
And that is
919-901-0861. 919. We love y'all.
Bye.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Wyatt. It's Avery out in Colorado. I love you, nerds. Congrats on your wedding. I was going to say engagement, but you're fucking married. I sobbed like a big baby. I love you guys. I hope you're doing well. Bye.